Been intrigued by 2000 AD, but never know where to start reading? Or are you a lapsed squat stick thargo from years ago? Prepare yourselves, Earthlit, for the next jumping on prog for 2000 AD, Prog 2050. Borag-thung, Earthlit, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am your host, Molchar, and this week we are diving into Prog 2050, the next jumping on issue for 2000 AD. Obviously, as a long-running anthology comic book, 2000 AD has many stories running concurrently and consecutively, blah, 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 blah. But with the jumping on progs, what we try to do is give Earthlits who aren't on board an opportunity to start reading by having all new stories starting together. And Prog 2050 is a bumper issue. We will have 7 Gafflebet thrills. Judge Dredd, the return of Rogue Trooper, Grey Area, Slain, the return of Indigo Prime and of Sinister Dexter, and the fall of Deadworld is back. And also, you'll get a little appearance from everyone's superhero pop star, Zenith, who will be celebrating his 30th birthday in this issue. On this episode of the Thrillcast, we're going to have James Robinson and Leo Manco, who are the creative team, brand new creative team, on the Rogue Trooper story, which is a 10-page special. Really great stuff. If you saw the preview online of Leo's artwork, it's absolutely incredible. And James, brand new writer for 2000 AD, but an established writer in his own right, has done a bang-up job on everyone's favourite blue-skinned genetic infantryman. And we're also going to be talking to Steve Yao, the artist behind Zenith, about this special anniversary appearance. So make sure you go along to your Thrill Merchant next Wednesday, the 27th of September, or download the 2000 AD app and purchase Prog 2050. If you are an ex-Squox, a wannabe Squox, or even just a normal Squox who wants to get into 2000 AD, it's a jam-packed issue, Earthlits, and we heartily recommend it to you. So let's crack on with this episode, and I got James Robinson and Leo Manco on the line to talk about their resurrection of Rogue Trooper. So to start off, James, tell us a little bit about how you came to be working on Rogue Trooper, because you're an established writer in your own right. What was the why did you want to write Rogue Trooper?
Well, honestly, it was the one thing I hadn't done. And, you know, looking at all of my contemporaries, I mean, when I was coming up, I was a little bit behind Grant Morrison and a bit more than that beyond Pete Milligan. They were sort of about my age, a little bit older. They are a little tiny little bit older than me. And it was sort of a rite of passage for them. And it seems like it was a rite of passage for so many writers who then went on to work in America. So the editor at the time just didn't like me. We didn't get on. Well, I had no problem with him, but he had a problem with me. So he told me, you're never going to write for this comic. So other opportunities came my way, and I went to America, became, you know, somewhat of a success there. But it always nagged me that I never got to do anything for 2000 AD. I never got to, you know, and I grew up loving it like every British comic book fan. So it sort of stuck there, and I was interviewed for I think it was the magazine. I don't remember what it was. It was either 2000 or the magazine. But I was interviewed and I mentioned all of this. I was even candid about the editor. And then there was a little, I saw a couple of Twitter things. Saw interview. You've got to give James Robinson something, you know, Tharg. You've got to give James Robinson something on Twitter. And I was like, well, that's nice. People are, you know, pro me doing something. And then I got a email out of the blue by Matt Smith saying, you know, was I interested in doing a Rogue Trooper 10-pager? And I was like, of course, that would be fantastic. And I, you know, Rogue was among my favorite characters. So then the only caveat he gave me was that using the traitor general, I mean to say. And then I saw Leo's lovely artwork, and it was just a really great experience.
For those listening who don't know your work for whatever reason, tell us a little bit about your background, what you have gone on to do, even though you weren't in 2000 AD when you were younger.
Well, I mean, I went to America. I wrote some, and that was a completely chance thing. I went to America for a different reason and ended up meeting my first wife and staying there. So, and I had through a graphic novel that I had written while I was in England called London's Dark that Titan Books published. I had met Matt Wagner and Archie Goodwin, who both, you know, liked the book and gave it endorsements on the back, et cetera. And Matt Wagner offered me Grendel Tales, taking over his character, or his universe. And Archie Goodwin, who was sort of going through transition himself, he was leaving Epic and going back to DC. He also was aware of me and wanted to give me work. So I did a graphic novel for Epic, and then went to DC and did The Golden Age, which was very, you know, very well regarded, myself and Paul Smith. And from there, I, you know, began to do Legends of the Dark Knights. I did Wildcats for Jim Lee. I did Legends of the Dark Knight. I said that. And then I began Starman, which was sort of the thing I was known for, which I did for many years, The Adventures of Jack Knight. I did that for 80-plus issues, and that is, you know, quite a highly regarded series. And then I, you know, went around and did what freelance writers do. I did some work for Marvel. I did some work for DC. Superman, Batman, Justice League, Justice Society, Cable. I mean, just recently I came back. I'm coming back to DC recently, but I've just written at Marvel. I was writing Scarlet Witch and Squadron Supreme, Fantastic Four. You know, I've just been a professional comic book writer for many years. I also have written screenplays. And I swear to God, it was a really good screenplay at one time, and it just became what it became. So I wrote The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the movie with Sean Connery, which is possibly the among the worst adaptions ever done. At the time I wrote the first script, it was much closer to the vision of Alan Moore, who I respect greatly and who I wanted to honor, and it all just went horribly wrong in the way that it can do when a lot of people have opinions, all putting them into the same piece of art, you know?
It's interesting to me, you mentioned about being a contemporary of Grant and Pete, by and large. The dominant narrative of that period of the 80s and 90s is so dominant because people go, well, you know, all the British people got work at 2000 AD and then were part of the British invasion. But of course, it kind of ignores all the people who weren't.
Yes.
And in terms of your experience, I mean, did you always have it in the back of your mind you wanted to work for 2000 AD, that the regime might change, that you know, there might be an opening there, or was this something that you went, well, oh well, I'll never work there?
Well, I mean, I'm ragging on old editors here, but I mean, the first editor who I guess I don't want to name names. If you know all the editors of 2000 AD, you can maybe put it all together. But the first guy didn't want me because I was, you know, getting covers for the artists he wanted to use. And then I did call up 2000 AD. I don't know how many years later, maybe 5 or 6 years later. And I said, oh, you know, I'm James Robinson. I wasn't like boastful. I was pretty humble, but I was like, I'm James Robinson. I've got a bit of a career in America. I still have to do something for 2000 AD. And the editor then, different guy, was like, well, I don't care. I don't want to do it. I have no interest in you. And I was like, oh, well, that's a nice British way to talk to a fellow Brit. And that sort of soured me a little bit. But at the same time, you know, I've still been reading 2000 AD, you know, for all this time. I'm a big fan of the tablet version of it. So, you know, the magazine and all of that. So I was, you know, that was a little bit disheartening, but, you know, I had so much going on in America. That was the point when I went, oh, well, I guess it's not meant to be. But here I am, you know, with a beautiful story done with me and Leo.
Well, let's turn to Leo. Leo, tell us a little bit about your background, because I think a lot of our readers are not necessarily people who keep up with American comics, so they may not have come into contact with your work. Tell us a little bit about how you got started in comics.
Well, what I think is maybe even the American people doesn't know what I did for them. But I started around in the beginning of the 90s, 93 exactly. I started to work for Marvel in the Book of Hellstorm with Warren Ellis. Then I did Druid, Werewolf by Night with Paul Jenkins, Then I did Blaze of Glory, Apache Skies with John Ostrander, few annuals of Wolverine, What If, Hellblazer, Doctor Doom for Marvel, Book of Batman. Then I've been working for independent publishers like Radical Publishing, you know. I've been working a couple of years ago, in fact, for a book made by John Carpenter, you know, the director of movies, you know, for his own book. And I've been doing a lot of things, but not many things, but for a long period. For example, in Hellblazer, I've been working for 5 years, you know.
That's quite a long time to be working on something like Hellblazer.
Yes. Well, this is one of my favorite characters, and I didn't want to give up with him, you know. So I passed through for many issues working on that title, but I'm still in love with that character, in fact. But yes. I work for Hellblazer for 5 years. Yes, I don't used to take a lot of books. You know, I remember I worked for Acclaim too, but we are talking about in the 90s mostly. But in the last 10 years, I've been working mostly for DC and Marvel and War Machine too. I don't remember, in fact, but yes, I'm trying to don't remember.
No worries. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be working on Rogue Trooper with James.
Well, it happens because I always am being interested into, you know, to try to do something for another market, you know. Outside of Unity State. So I started to check it out, page of 2000 AD, and I sent a couple of emails. And one day, Matt Smith responds my email with this proposal. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it because, being honest, I found in Rogue Trooper a character that I really like to do since I was a teenager, you know? Because, how I can explain, I don't like superheroes at all. And Rogue Trooper looks like more a hero than a superhero, so I feel more comfortable drawing to them, you know, that kind of characters. So I couldn't believe it when I found that email of Matt Smith in my inbox. My son is helping me with my English. I'm sorry.
Okay.
He's better than me. Was like a kind of dream come true for me. Really, because I thought, fuck, at last, a good character to draw, you know? Yes, exactly, it's the truth.
Brilliant.
It's the truth.
Brilliant.
And let me tell you something, this is very important. When I received the script, I didn't know any idea about who was the writer, because the script wasn't signed by James Robinson, you know?
Right. Yes.
I didn't know who was the writer. But when I read the script, I thought, this is really good. Who is this guy? I don't care. He's really good. Then I figured out later when I finished the pages that the writer was James Robinson, and I couldn't believe it. James, that's the truth, you know.
Well,
you sent the script. You know, it wasn't signed by James Robinson. It was only the letters of your name. I didn't realize who was you.
Well, I'm glad I got to surprise you.
yes, was very nice. It was very nice to me, you know. That's it. My life is very short.
Well, Leah, let's talk a little bit about your take on Rogue Trooper. I detect in the way that you've drawn him quite a bit of The original Dave Gibbons, the original co-creator of it, particularly there's a couple of frames set during the Quartz Zone massacre where it really pops that you've been influenced by Dave's work.
Yes, that's true. Well, I grew up reading that kind of stories. For example, as I told you before, I don't like superheroes because I don't feel identified with that kind of art, you know? Mm. The art that the artist used to use to draw superheroes. But Dave Gibbons is more European, you know, well. And I feel more comfortable, and I grow up reading that kind of stories with those kind of artists, you know? And besides that, Rock Trooper deserves to have that kind of art for the book, you know? I have to, in some way, to follow the steps that Gibbons set up for the book from the beginning, you know? Mm. Because the character needs. I have to put my own stuff because, okay, I had to be myself too. But it's a way to make a kind of match to him, you know? And it's like to extend in some way these days what he created for that universe, doing that kind of it's a kind of legacy, you know? Hmm. What I'm trying to. So my English is terrible, but I'm
sorry. No, you're doing great.
I told you, you're going to find my accent terrible. But what I'm trying to say is I can't cross the line, you know, pretending to do something different with this book because it's a classic. And the people, the followers and the people who are waiting for something with this character is to try to remember, to try to recover those years in these days. But I have to add new stuff, and that's what I put from myself. But basically, what I did is, even in Spanish, I can't explain. But I try to do something good for everyone, you know.
Sure.
I've been working with a lot of pressure, you know, because it's a very important character, and you can't play fool, you know, doing something like this. You must respect it. Mm. That's the point. It's about to respect. It's about to respect. In fact, the childhood of many people that are going to take this book again in some way, or the new generations, I have to link the generations between what Dave Gibbons and the rest of the guys did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, with the guys who are going to read them again, you know?
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
That's my duty in some way.
That nicely brings me on to talking to James about this, because James, you know, fan of Rogue Trooper. It's not when Rogue Trooper was rebooted in the 90s. I'm thinking after Dave Gibbons's War Machine, going into the kind of Friday era. Yeah. It's not always worked. It's often been a character that hasn't has found it difficult to find its feet in subsequent stories. Did you feel a pressure there to as Leo was saying, to link back to the original, but also try and bring something new?
Well, yes. I mean, the one thing Leo sort of touched on it a little bit a moment ago is, for everybody that's like a comic fan and reads 2000 AD and reads Marvel and DC and Bandai Senai, whatever, there's far more people that just read 2000 AD in England. Hmm. And what that does, what that has done, is make them incredibly focused on all these characters. And like, in terms of iconic 2000 AD characters, you know, there's Dread, you know, in that top tier, there's Dread, obviously. And then below that, what else? Strontium Dog, Road Trooper,
Slain.
Now, I mean, yeah, there are different characters now, Slain, you know, a few, but people love that character. So, and then, you know, it was a 10-page story referencing, although not obviously involving, the Traitor General. And I felt like we were doing a story that was like between two issues of the Road Trooper of the Dave Gibbons version or the Cam Kennedy version. So with that said, I did feel the weight of the responsibility to tell a good story, and sort of like also what I had to do was sort of reintroduce people to that time of Road Trooper. So there was a lot to get in whilst also trying to tell a compelling story, which is why I did it in the third person. Well, not the third person, but through the eyes of the officer that Rogue is attacking, and also within the tank. And then also, you know, I didn't use, you know, Helm or Gunner or those extra characters that follow along with Rogue, because there just wasn't room in 10 pages to do that much extrapolation.
Hmm.
So I did feel, you know, the weight of trying to put all of that into 10 pages and tell a compelling story that wasn't just a retelling it wasn't too much just a retelling of past events, which sometimes those little stories can become if you're not careful. So I was, you know, I had all of that, you know, I'm in my mind, you know, et cetera. And then, but then, you know, one of the things that helps it was like Leo's artwork was so concise and beautifully, you know, it had that kind of dirty feel like war, but at the same time, which is, you know, Leo's, I think his pen work, but it was very clear and concise at the same time. So I was able to get all that information into the story while also relaying these events around Rogue's past, whilst also telling a story that was set, you know, in the present of that moment. You know, so you're right. Things haven't gone well in terms of, that's unfair. Things have, you know, Rogue isn't the character that he used to be. He has kind of gotten a little bit lost with all the stuff, but I do have an idea to bring all that together and maybe turn it into something. So if you like the 10 pager, maybe Leo and I could do more with the character.
I'll leave that up to Thag the Mighty, I think, yes, on the decision
absolutely.
On that one. Wait, I mean, what's the appeal of a character like Rogue Trooper? Because as we say, you know, at the beginning he had that singular mission to find the Traitor General. It struggled to find its feet a bit after that, though, you know, there's stories like Cinnabar by John Smith and Steve Dillon and Kev Walker, which is fantastic, and even some of the later stuff is like the 21st century stuff is great. But what in essence does the character do for you?
Okay, well, I would say that one of the things about Road Trooper, when he works at his best, and you know what, I think that's true in a way of Dread, even that Dread is. Dread, you know, these amazing stories surround Dread, you know, they've been going on for decades and decades, but he's very simple to understand in his, you know, he's a very simplistic view of life and of the lore and everything else. So as a result, you can hang all this amazing storyline on the character and you get the character immediately. I think with Rogue Trooper, it's sort of the same way in that and I'm talking about Rogue Trooper from Dave Gibbons through to, you know, the end, the classic Road Trooper is, it's basically just a revenge story. You know, it's Nevada Smith, the movie Nevada Smith, where the bad guys kill his parents and he gets into all these adventures along the way, but all he really wants to do is get revenge on those guys. It's like, you know, The Unforgiven. It's like all of these, I know it's a war comic or a war character, but in many ways it feels like a Western character, that sort of the lonely, lone man that has a mission and he's not going to stop. But along the way, he helps people and then he moves on. I mean, that sort of was the formula for Rogue. And I think that it works really, really, it works really well because it's so clean and to understand. And then, you know, because, you know, one man by himself can get monotonous sometimes in narrative if it goes on too long. Like the genius of adding, you know, Gunner and Helm, and my mind is blanking on the third one. Who was it? Gunner, Helm, and
Bagman.
Adding those as his sort of like Greek chorus of conscience and thought and everything else was sort of inspired. And as I mentioned in an email, I think, to you or to somebody for the interview, we did a written interview a little while ago.
Yeah.
But it also reminded me of when Robert Kaniger, who was a genius at doing like war comics, you know, for DC, Sergeant Rock and all these characters, and then also single issue war stories, he would do these ones where he was a gun, or he was some part of he was the shovel digging a foxhole, and the whole story would be narrated by that thing, you know, showing a perspective on the battle. There was even a fantastic story in I can even tell you what it was. This is what a geek I am. It was Danger Trails issue 3, with art by Alex Toth, brilliant art, where the observer or the narrator was the French flag of the French Foreign Legion out in the desert. So, I mean, that sort of thing also, I feel there's a little bit of that in Rogue Trooper, which I think adds a life and a personality to it. But at the root, it is this classic revenge story, which fits so well into Westerns and crime stories, you know. So in many ways, he's sort of a classic character in the bigger sense, not just a comic book character, but those classic fiction characters. And I think that's the appeal. He's so easy to understand, and then there's this sort of weird, lawless, crazy world he's in, where, you know, you can't breathe the air and you can't see in front of you because of the gas and everything else, which just adds to the almost, and that kind of gives it almost a horror feel. So it's a combination of all these different elements from different genres and the feel of, you know, different kinds of story that I think makes him interesting. What, because he stays so clean and you get his motivation so easily.
Leo, I'll come to you and ask the same thing about what appeals to you about Rogue, because one of the things that I know Carla Sesquera talks a lot about with Judge Dredd is about silhouettes, about how important the silhouette of a character is. And of course, Rogue has that classic silhouette, you know, that with his helmet and with his backpack and with his gun and with mm-hmm. the rest of his uniform. Is there an intrinsic appeal to the kind of simplicity of Rogue's design, the economy of Rogue's design?
Well, I'm going to need the help of my son to explain this, because it's very important and I want to find the perfect words for to explain it. So he's going to speak for me. Okay,
sure.
Here is my son, Augusto.
Hello, Augusto.
Hello, guys.
Hey, hello.
Lo clásico nunca va a pasar de moda.
The classics will always remain new. You know,
the simplicity of these characters, esto no se adapta a ninguna moda. La simplicidad del diseño de este personaje puede siempre puede sobrevivir al tiempo y a las modas.
The simplicity of this character will always be adaptable to the tendencies and the trends that are in the media.
So
it survives.
Entonces, un personaje así podemos tratarlo de diferentes maneras, adaptándolo a cualquier historia, cualquiera sea la tendencia de moda en el momento.
So a character like this can be adapted to any story in any way, no matter what the trend and the moment may be.
Lo que me gusta de este personaje es que podemos mezclar, por ejemplo, con James, lo mejor de la ciencia ficción de los años 80 con lo mejor de la ciencia ficción de este último año. Y puede encajar perfectamente, porque el diseño es adaptable. Lo que debe ser adaptable tiene que ser la historia al diseño en sí también.
So, the good thing is that we can work with James to make a story that can combine both, you know, the 80s science fiction with today's science fiction. You know, the story needs to be adaptable to the design.
y al mundo en donde lo podemos poner al personaje.
And the world which we can put the character in.
Volviendo a una de las preguntas que le hacías a James al principio.
Going back to one of the questions that you were making James at the beginning.
Cuando yo leí esta primera historia, esta historia de 10 páginas.
When I first read this 10-page story.
Lo que yo sentí es que James trataba de contar algo más que 10 páginas. O sea,
what I felt was that James was trying to tell a story that was more than just 10 pages.
Esto me hizo replantear todo lo que tendría que hacer dentro de estas 10 páginas.
Which made me think everything that I would have is 10 pages.
Al principio yo creí que llegaría una historia clásica, típica, de rock trooper matando gente en un escenario de Newark. Before to receive the script of James, I thought the story going to be on a story of rock trooper, you know, killing soldiers in the Newark landscape or something like that, you know, something. So, okay, but when I received the script of James, I saw a lot of elements around there, and I thought, okay, this is like a pilot issue for something more bigger. I say it before, in fact, because I saw a lot of elements there for to start with something more bigger. So I thought, okay, we have the elements of the character of Rock Trooper, a simple character like Rock Trooper, you know, with the backpack, as you said, but we have the interior of the tank with all those hoods and leads and such. So I thought to mix both worlds, you know, in one, for to create a new beginning, a new visual beginning for the character in some way. At first I think, okay, maybe this is only the 10 pages that I have to do for Rogue Trooper, and okay, so let's set up something, nothing more. But Rogue Trooper is a very good character for to keep working today and in 20 years in the future, because let's put it on this way. The point is, I want to close the idea. For example, doesn't matter how it looks like the character, it's the way you work on it. For example, James Bond is a classic character, and he, in those days, still killing people, you know? So, and it's a great movie. The point is the way you do the project. And Rock Trooper is an amazing character for to keep working and keep discovering with good stories, with a lot of things around him, you know? It's an adventure. Rock Trooper is pure adventure for to tell with a lot of images, you know, and I love him. That's it.
Brilliant.
Okay.
One of the standout characters from the last 40 years of 2000 AD has been Grant Morrison and Steve Yeo's Zenith, a spoiled, insecure, self-obsessed pop star who also happens to be a superhero. The four books of the original run are available from 2000 AD's webshop and apps, and also all good bookstores and comic book stores. But this year marks the 30th anniversary since the first episode of Zenith appearing in 2000 AD. So I got Steve Yeo, the artist on Zenith, on the line to talk about this special appearance, what Zenith means to him, and just what the Super Brat superstar superhero has been up to over the past decade or so. So Steve, it's the 30th anniversary of Zenith this year, and he has a special appearance in Prog 2050, which let's just say the cat has been amongst the pigeons with this one ever since we told people it was happening. Tell us a little bit about how this came to be.
Well, I got an email out of the blue from Matt Smith, just saying that he had an idea to write a Zenith piece based around the fact that he was, he'll be in his 50s now, won't he? And was I up for drawing an illustration to accompany it? And actually, it's always good fun revamping the costume and his appearance every now and again. So naturally, I said yes, yeah, no worries. So he liked the tinkering I did with the costume design, which wasn't a lot, to be fair, because, you know, obviously the T-shirt doesn't change. He's got the tattoos that he sported in Zenith.com. It was just a question of really giving them a new pair of boots and a new pair of jeans and giving him some face hair. For some bizarre reason, everyone thinks it's based on you.
Yeah, that was slightly freaky when I opened up the image that Matt sent me. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. But just to be
I actually based it on Johnny Depp. So, you know.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. I've mixed feelings about Johnny Depp. It is odd to look at, but I mean, let's talk a little bit about the decisions you make to revamp the way he looks, because of course with the later stories which are in the Complete Zenith collection, you updated him based on the way that pop culture was going at the time, because I think Robbie Williams was an influence on one of the episodes.
Yeah, I kind of, you're talking about Zenith.com, aren't you? Yeah, that was partly Robbie Williams. In fact, it was mostly Robbie Williams, I think, the hairstyle particularly.
Yeah.
And I kind of had a scene in that where he was dressed in a sarong, Beckham-like. I think, David Beckham and David and Victoria Beckham had just appeared in a batch of photos with Beckham in a sarong. So I thought, oh, that'd be a good idea. And that was actually one of the costume designs I pitched to Andy Diggle at the time. But we went with the I can't remember what you'd recall those trousers he's wearing. They're kind of skater jeans, I think, with the padded knees.
Yeah,
we went with that, and I just dropped the sarong into the strip at a suitable point, because I quite liked it as a design. So I thought, well, you know, waste not, want not.
How much is for you? How much is Zenith a reflection of just what's out there at the time? So when he first started, it was very much that, you know, he was the super brat. He was that kind of self-obsessed 1980s pop star. How integral is that to him as a character? Is this more just kind of window dressing for the personality that comes out through the story?
Well, I think it's very integral to him as a character, isn't it? Because obviously he has a career to think about. He's got money matters to think about, and he's always going to have one eye on the zeitgeist. But unfortunately, because of his age, rather like me, he's only got half an eye really on what's going on. And so almost inevitably you kind of get sucked into this going touring for the old fans thing, don't you? I mean, you know how many 1980s groups and pop stars are doing tours at the moment, and I'm not quite sure if they're trying to relaunch their careers or just settle a tax bill, but they all look slightly too old to be doing it, don't they?
There are one or two that kind of seem as if almost they're like a tribute act to themselves.
That's it, yeah, that's exactly the term I'm looking for, yeah.
And I mean, have you read the piece that Matt wrote?
I haven't been party to it yet, so it's okay. Going to be a big surprise for me as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, you mentioned Johnny Depp there, but in terms of the kind of pop culture, are you referencing anybody in particular with the way that he's dressed at the moment, or is it just stuff that you've picked up?
It's just little bits and pieces I've picked up. Yeah. I kind of did a quick Google search to see what people were wearing. I suppose I managed to dredge something up from the back of my mind that kind of looked a bit old 80s pop star trying to dress as a rocker kind of a thing.
I We talked quite a bit about Zenith when we had the chat for the supplemental episodes a while back. But just to kind of recap, what place does Zenith have within your career? Is, I mean, you know, people talk about phase one and phase two showing such a kind of change and a maturing of your style. Where does he sit? What places he has? What importance does he has in your does he have in your career?
Well, he kind of looms over it like a colossus, doesn't he? Really? Yeah. I mean, in terms of my changing, I don't know, think of it as a changing style. In terms of my learning experience, I was learning everything on the job when I was drawing him.
Mm.
So you know, everything I am now, I probably owe to him, to be quite frank.
And a lot is made of Grant plugging into the zeitgeist at the time, of knowledge of pop music and things like that. Was that similarly your story? What kind of person were you in the 80s? Were you in that kind of, you know, pop culture milieu, or was it something you saw from the outside?
No, I was... Well, I mean, do you mean, was I in a band?
Yeah.
I was in no way in a band. I was a kind of, I was reading the newspapers regularly and buying lots of records and going to lots of gigs, I believe young people refer to them as. So, I mean, I was involved in it as a punter, as a fan, but I wasn't involved in it as a band member or anything like that, no.
And how do you feel about it being 30 years since that first episode appearing?
Has it been that long? Do you know, I try not to think too much about the time passing. it's funny looking back, yeah. I try not to think too much about the time passing, but at the same time, it's good fun looking back at that stuff. Yeah, happy days.
One of the things that we just talked about now was this idea of pop stars becoming almost like a tribute act to themselves after many years. How do you feel about Zenith coming back? You know, when you had that, you know, what seemed like a complete story where you had the four phases. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about him coming back now? How do you feel about this appearance? Is this just... an addendum at the end? Is it a tribute? Is it something more, something new? You know, and is there a risk of characters becoming effectively sort of fan films of themselves, if you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, he's still there. You got my brain gears cranking over there. Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, he's still there. He hasn't gone away, and he's not going to go away. Quite how much of a presence he makes of himself, I guess, remains to be seen.
Obviously, we brought out the complete Zenith for the first time in the single edition, and then in the four separate volumes. Has that made a difference to the way that people talked to you about Zenith? Are new people discovering it? Are you noticing at conventions that people are coming to it fresh?
I definitely know some people have. I mean, if only because old Zenith fans are introducing them to it. I can remember speaking to Paul in Eskillion, and he'd introduced some younger... I'm not sure if one of the chaps was his son. But anyway, he introduced some youngsters to Zenith, and they seemed to enjoy it. So I'm guessing, and obviously I haven't spoken to everyone, I'm guessing that there are young... In fact, I have had some youngsters come up to me for a Zenith sketch at signings, because they've been given copies of 2000 AD with him in by uncles, fathers, extended family, and they seem to enjoy it.
How do you feel about that it's been around long enough to go on, pass on to another generation, as it were?
Well, it is great. I'm sort of flattered if anyone comes up to me and asks me to draw anything for them. Yeah, but flattered.
And looking ahead, obviously Grant isn't going to be writing it anymore. Would you welcome a revival of Zenith? And I'm not speaking from a kind of corporate interrogation kind of way. I'm just interested in you know, if Matt came to you at some later point and said, actually, we're thinking of restarting it as a strip. What would be your feelings about that?
Well, I'd want first refusal. Let's put it like that.
We've talked about the fact that it's 30 years that he's, you know, such an important point in your career. He's aged in real time, as have we all. How do you feel about growing old with one of your creations?
Well, it's almost inevitable, isn't it? When you're so closely associated with a particular character. I'm not the only person that's kind of found themselves in a similar situation. I know Gil Kane was always associated with Green Lantern, even if he'd gone drawn a squillion other pages. So, how do I feel? Well, like I say, I'm flattered to be associated with such a popular character. More than happy. And if I don't say that, it'll boot me up.
That seems cruel. Have you got a favourite moment in Zenith? Is there a page that you're particularly fond of, or a moment that you really enjoyed?
Lots of them. I enjoyed the big reveal at the end of phase three when everyone thought he was dead. And he bobbed out of the back room. And revealed it was Vertex that had been killed. It's so hard to pick out a particular moment above the others. Funny enough, the fight with Warhead, I kind of enjoyed with another big reveal that it was his father. And just technically, there was a sequence in phase two with the atomic submarine that, you know, as a piece of working out the storytelling, I kind of always look back on that episode as with fun. Even though Zenith's not in it, actually, it's the interview that St. John is giving to the TV current affairs program. And it's kind of cutting backwards and forwards between that and the nuclear submarine that Wallace is taking over the computer systems of. And I just remember really enjoying during that episode and kind of looking back on it still and thinking, yeah, that structurally, that's a really nice piece of writing there.
And as I said, the cat's been in amongst the pigeons somewhat over the last week or so after we revealed the image that you've done. How did that feel to see that so many people have still got such strong emotions about Zenith?
It was great. Yeah, I mean, whatever people say, you know what they say, all publicity is good publicity, good or bad. it's quite fun, you know, watching the hand grenade go off sometimes, isn't it? Everyone having a good argument about which is their favorite phase, but yeah, great.
And that's all we have time for, I'm afraid, Earthlets. This episode has been pretty packed, but not as packed as the bumper jumping on issue Prog 2050, which is out next week. Hope you've enjoyed the chats. Thanks to James and Leo and Steve for chatting. And do let us know what you think about the jumping on issue and the 2080 Thrillcast, Earthlets, on thrillcast@2080online.com. That's thrillcast@2080online.com. Look forward to hearing from you. Until next time. Splendid Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10, and download DRM free copies from 2080online.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2080 on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2080online and follow on Instagram at Insta2080. Program complete. Shutting down.